A guy can't get around some of that stuff. I did talk with the DNR this morning. Our access road up the south side of Octopus, where our cable goes up there and feeds the repeaters at Octopus, there was a culvert that plugged there. The DNR got that cleaned up this morning, and they went up the hill a little bit, and there's another culvert washed out there. Just up the hill a little ways from that, it looks like it pulled in half and half the road's gone. A guy can get a pickup around it, but the DNR said they're going to get on that pretty quick here and start getting that fixed too and put in a new pipe there.
Okay, it's 1:30. Let's call the meeting to order. Welcome to the December 13th, 2021 Board of Commissioners meeting. Yet again, we're still Zooming. I'm sure we're going to be Zooming for quite some time. First item on the agenda is approval of the consent agenda. We have five items.
I move we accept the consent agenda.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda for December 13, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Agenda revisions. Do we have any, Doug or Sean?
I just need to point out that item G, which doesn't really have a name attached to it, Sean's going to be given that on the strategic plan. And then you don't have to add anything, but Tom, when he does item E, the resolution, Tom's going to be giving us all an update on what's happening out west.
Hey, Will, I would like to suggest that we change the position of strategic plan and put it after the BPA post-2028 contracts discussion, because some of the things that I want to bring up in the contract discussion are germane to the strategic plan.
Okay. Let's see. Where are we here? All right. So we'll move G down to below I. Is that what you're supposed to? Okay, good. Anything else? Okay, good. All right. Comments from the public. Sean, can you police this?
You bet. If there's anybody out there who would like to make a comment, please give me your first name now.
Hi, it is Paul Pickett.
Anybody else?
Richard here.
Richard? Looks like Paul and Richard, Will.
Okay, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, and I had a couple comments, a couple comments on the strategic plan. Is this the appropriate time to give you those?
We limit you to 3 minutes, but go ahead.
Okay, I'll go with it here in 3 minutes. There were two main areas I wanted to comment on, and one had to do with the section on environmental, you had an environmental section, I forget the exact words, and my comment on that is that that section emphasizes compliance with regulations. And I just want to note that that really is the bare minimum. Under the principles of triple bottom line, which some of you may have heard of, they talk about the levels of environmental compliance an organization can go through. And I would really encourage a stronger environmental message than just meeting regulations. I would suggest that the focus should be building environmental goals into your organizational policies. And the ISO 14001 is a really good model for that. Many organizations, ports, and other organizations have built their environmental policies into their organization rather than just the minimum meeting. Of course, you have to meet regulations. I'm not arguing that, but I think you can go a little farther than that. So I think, and that helps you to examine future challenges and be much more proactive. The second part I want to talk about was climate change. And this overlaps several areas. It includes risk management and some other areas that I think in your resource portfolio, I think there are issues with climate change impacting your energy sources and water for that matter. But mainly I'm thinking of, you know, the cycles of droughts that we're seeing more and more of and the kind of thing that happened in 2015 with loss of hydropower. So I think that to look at the resource portfolio from a climate opens issues that overlap into the issue of risk management, because you're managing a very uncertain future for your energy sources. And it even overlaps into customer partnerships in the sense that I would really like to see a strong initiative to build your local power base, to try and take advantage where it's possible of solar and wind generation at the small scale, at the homeowner scale, perhaps, or business, you know, large building scale in Fallon County. So I think it's more than just a 1 year. There's a long-term vision, but in the 1 year plan to start thinking about, you know, building a stronger local energy base that'll help you get through any burps that come out of the BPA side of your sources. I would just add again, I think that's a customer partnership issue, because you could be working with your people who have homes in the area to try and put some of this power. There's also a term, I helped the state write the state's climate response plan when I worked with Department of Ecology years ago. And there's a thing called a vulnerability assessment. And I don't know if you've done that, but it's a very powerful tool that many organizations have used, where you look at the climate, you bring in climate experts, look at the climate future, and look at your vulnerabilities. I think what's happened with the slide and your mains over at Glalam and Conlon Bay and CQ, with the climate signal of strong precipitation events.
Okay, Paul, I'm going to need to interrupt you. You've gone well over 3 minutes, so.
You're very kind. That's it. Thank you.
Get somebody else a chance to talk. Richard, I think you're next.
Yes, thanks for the opportunity, and amen to Paul there, by golly. I'm on the same page as he is. However, my comments today are in regards to redistricting. And I've been looking at the history of how Port Angeles has been involved in voting on PUD issues and not. Today, if I might, I'd like to read a response that I've gotten from PUD as to my comments and questions. So real quickly, I wrote a email and simply said, are there Clallam PUD ratepayers who are excluded from voting because they reside in the Port Angeles city boundaries? Nicole Hartman responded promptly. Thank you, Nicole. Hi, Mr. DeBusman. We do actually have some customers who are excluded from voting, both in Jefferson County, south of Forks, and some in the Port Angeles city limits, primarily the water-only customers that we serve in East Port Angeles, who receive electrical power from the city of PA. It is possible we might have an electrical customer who is served by us but might reside in one of the city voting precincts, as the precinct boundaries may not precisely line up with our system boundaries, but we are required by law to keep the precincts intact when we establish districting. We do not have a list of these customers. So I would request that somehow we see if we can't get a list of those customers to see just what kind of an issue is this. Is this a big issue or is this a non-issue? So that concludes my remarks. And again, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. Thank you for your remarks. Anyone else, Sean?
I heard no others, Will.
Okay. We'll move on to business items. Our first item is acceptance memo for completion of the demolition and disposal of shed containing lead coating. Bill, I think you have that one.
Bill, you're on mute.
Okay. Hear me now?
We can hear you, Bill.
Yeah. Okay. This is acceptance of memo completion for bid opening, which was on October 14th, 2021. demolition and disposal of a shed with lead-containing coating at 441 West E Street in Forks, bid number 211006. All work under the above reference contract with Roglands has been completed. It is recommended that this work be accepted as complete. The project consisted of all work required for the complete demolition, removal, and proper disposal of a 1,000 square foot digger shed with a lead containing coating. The contractor started the project on November 15th, 2021, completed the work November 24th, 2021. Total contract cost was $65,100, including Washington State sales tax.
Will, you're muted.
You still can't hear me?
I'm the one that's muted. Sorry about that. you think I get used to this after a while, but oh well. So do we have any discussion or questions about this or a motion?
I move we accept the memo of completion of the demolition of the disposal shed.
I second that.
And moved and seconded to approve acceptance of memo of completion for bid number 211006 for demolition and disposal of shed with lead containing coating at 411 West East Street in Forks, Washington. The contractor, Roglands, Inc., completed the project November the 24th, 2021. The total contract cost is $65,100, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, our next item will be Resolution 223-21, authorizing the disposal of surplus material. Charlie, are you on?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Charlie. Yeah.
Hey, we just have one vehicle here. It's a 2001 Dodge Ram 2500 HD 4x4. It has no value to meet the current business needs of the district. It's run its course of life, and we deem it to be declared surplus. And I believe you saw all the stuff that's wrong with this vehicle. So
it's a lengthy list, well, which is no surprise. It's 2001, so it's quite old.
It has more issues than I do.
Okay, well, thank you, Charlie.
I move that we accept Resolution 2223-21, authorizing the disposal of surplus material.
I'll second the motion.
The moved and seconded to approve Resolution 223-21, authorizing the disposal of a 2001 Dodge Ram 2500 with 168,540 miles and transmission slippage. The vehicle requires extensive repairs and is no longer needed by the district. The estimated surplus value of this vehicle is $4,000. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you, guys. Happy holidays.
Okay, Charlie, same to you. Our next item is Resolution 224-21, revising the district's residential meter policy. John, I think you have that one.
Yes, Will. Staff requests a motion, second, and a vote to approve Resolution 2224-21, revising the district's residential meter policy to eliminate the self-read option from the policy and to rescind Resolution 2141-19. Sean, if I could share a screen.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so basically in our current policy, we formulated March of 2019, we introduced a pilot project to include a self-read option. Which includes, photograph, customer read, email the PUD, and for us to validate twice a year on the reads. And unfortunately, we never had more than one participant in the self-read pilot. And when we originally evaluated this project, we were looking at, you know, a fairly nominal overhead cost, but how to allocate that among number of participating customers. And I believe we were looking at 100 or 200 participants on the costing, and we came in, you know, of course, well under that. So it's never been a really viable policy. And when we did the economic evaluation and the last deposits and charges, the self-read option actually lined out at a higher amount than the PD read opt-out. So therefore, we no longer have any customers in the pilot, and we'd like to remove the language that set up the self-read pilot. You know, technically, this was going to run until April 1st, 2019, but without a participant, we see no reason to continue the pilot.
Okay, discussions, questions? This was a big item back in the day, but it sounds like it's not a lot of energy around it now.
This, I assume this was part of the AMI procedures or whatnot. I can't see the top of the.
So basically, yes, Jim. When we did AMI, we implemented an opt-out residential.
Right, yeah. Okay, you answered my question.
Yes. And as a pilot, we were going to include a self-read option, which at that time was evaluated at $15 a month, when the PUD option was $18 a month. Subsequently, due to a lack of interest, the self-read option overheads, even though fairly nominal, do not make it cost viable. And we no longer have people interested in pursuing it, so we'd like to get rid of this option.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, you answered my basic question. It's part of the original package, but I do have a follow-up question, but it doesn't affect this language. So if you want to vote on this, we can.
Okay, do we have a motion? Jim, was that a motion?
Yeah, I'll put forth a motion that we move to support Resolution 22-24-21, revising the district's residential meter policy.
I second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 224-21, revising the district's residential meter policy to eliminate the self-read option from the policy and to rescind Resolution 2141-19. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you.
Jim, did you have a question?
Yeah, can like in one sentence tell me roughly how many AMI meters have been installed by percentage would be fine.
Whole numbers. We're a little bit behind because of COVID, but we've installed, I believe, a little over 7,000 AMI meters.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, our next item is Resolution 225-21. Establishing the current electric service regulations and requirements. Colin, I think you have that one.
Thank you, President Purser. Today we're talking about adding two components. One would be a substation capacity definition, and another would be adding the substation capacity charge to Section 3 of the line extension regulations that you have before you. A little background. As a PUD standard, we tend to try to update substations when loading increases above 80% or around that point. We do this as because we want capacity available in substation transformers for contingency needs as they arise. It adds flexibility and keeps the lights on for customers. In subs with limited capacity, we use mobile substation transformers to support abnormal loading conditions with the ultimate goal of being to replace transformers with lower capacity. replace lower capacity transformers with higher capacity transformers. If a substation is at or near 80%, this will trigger the process to begin planning for a new transformer substation upgrade. So given that information, under normal conditions, new single small customer loads increase substation peak load gradually, giving us plenty of time to plan for the future and upgrading substations. But unlike small loads, large spot load customers can add substantial load to substation transformers and will trigger that date to be moved up much sooner. And what that means is if a new spot load comes and makes a request, say, hey, I want to add a couple megawatts, we look at the load and say, okay, our transformer's preloaded up here, we're going to probably have to replace it soon. And given our policy, what that would mean is the customer would actually, with the way the policy is designed at the moment, the customer would be required to pay for the whole transformer upgrade. The result being that transformer substation transformer upgrades are pretty expensive, the customer's not going to do their, they're not going to add the new large load. And what will happen is the load will continue to gradually grow on the substation transformer, and then we'll just replace it, you know, based on essentially everyone in the district's going to contribute to the cost of that substation upgrade. And then maybe a new spot load comes along and there's a lot of capacity and they can get on without adding to the payment of that new transformer. Hopefully I'm making sense here. I feel like I'm kind of drifting a little bit. The point is we don't get the new load addition if we're heavily loaded because it's cost prohibitive, but then another load could easily come on when there's less capacity. So what we want to do is we want to capture that cost at the time that the customer is making the request and do it in a way that makes sense, because really that customer shouldn't be on the hook for the entire substation upgrade. They should be paying for what their capacity needs are. And so what this new equation essentially does is it charges a much lower rate, so we'll have a much higher likelihood of a new spot load addition, and we'll be capturing the costs that they're adding for the requirement of a new shop. And that's kind of the background of why we would like to do this change.
Colin, this is Rick.
Yeah.
It seems that if a new large single load comes in to a substation and takes up, say, 10% of the capability, that new single load should pay for 10% of the substation, whether we have to put a new transformer in or not. In other words, they pay for what they use regardless of whether we're on the threshold of having to put a new substation in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I think what we're looking here to is really capture the cost of that transition from one transformer to another, and that there's that one-time cost. In this situation we're talking, ideally that customer is also contributing load over the long term that helps defray the cost. A larger spot load should have a larger load as well. I think John might have some other thoughts too.
Yeah, Rick, there's a lot of, you know, kind of agreement with you on what connecting customers should support for capacity charges. Unfortunately, that's not how it's been in the past here. So basically, right now there is no substation capacity charge for any customer who is new and oncoming. This language is what I would call a half a step in that direction.
So what type of, are these residential developments, grow operations, what's a typical step function?
What we're seeing happening is single new additions. There's been cultivators that use lots of high-intensity lights that are coming online. We also have two potential sawmills that we've been in talks with. I don't have a lot of details about that, but usually these are 99% of new loads would not trigger this change.
So basically what you're proposing would kind of incentivize not disincentivize growth in residential or industrial or any single load requirement. Is that a fair statement?
Well, let me jump in. Basically, we believe this is fair, basically. We try to come up with something that is fair to the customer. It's not fair to a customer who wants to add, let's say, several megawatts to a transformer that's near capacity and charge them the replacement transformer cost, because that replacement transformer includes a great deal of additional capacity that will be basically for future customers because it's, you know, will no longer be close to being overloaded. So it will also serve as an incentive for cases where, let's say, a customer comes in, wants to add a couple megawatt load, and instead of paying a, you know, $500,000 substation upgrade, they'll be paying something less for the substation capacity, you know, $70,000-$80,000, which is more in line with what their other line extension costs might be. So it's an attempt to be fair, to come up with a fairness that will still allow large industrial customers to come in without telling them, sorry, you have to pay a tremendous bill. We're just trying to be fair, both to existing ratepayers as well as new customers.
How does this compare with our water LUD policies as far as expanding service? Are we consistent here or not?
Well, right now, the water policy, you know, Rick had a suggestion about capacity charges.
Yeah.
Water, I believe, has that built into every service.
Yeah,
and we can move to that eventually. It's desirable. This is just the first step in that direction.
Okay. Yeah, sounds fair, I guess. If we... Anyway, the LUD model is rigged. Did you have other questions on this? Or?
No, sir, but I do think that we should think about moving to some type of capacity charge all around.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. So sounds like we're moving in that direction. Don't know what the timeline is, but...
Okay, well, then I'll take that as an action item to look into.
Okay.
Capacity charge for basically every rate class we're talking, residential, commercial?
Potentially, yeah. We'll have to come up with different options, Colin.
Jim, do you have any views on this?
No, I think that's fine to look into it.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Colin and John.
Welcome.
So we have a resolution before us, 2225-21.
I move that we accept resolution 2225-21 establishing current electric service regulations and requirements.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2225-21. Establishing the current electric service regulations and requirements, and to rescind resolution 2201-21. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Good. Thank you. Thanks, Colin. Okay, our next item is resolution 2228-21, amending resolution 2221-21. Declaring an emergency and authorizing emergency repair work in Clallam Bay CQ. Tom, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, go for it.
Good afternoon, commissioners.
Good afternoon.
Staff has prepared this resolution 2228-21 for the commissioners' consideration for adoption. The previous resolution that's being amended was adopted 2 weeks ago at the last meeting, which allowed the staff to go forward and contract with, basically the construction contractors and the electrical contractors, to respond to the initial emergency. Now we're in a phase where we'd like to start designing, a more permanent, still you know, an initial repair to get the bypass pipeline in a more stable situation than it is now. And that's what this resolution is for. It's for allowing the staff to contract with our existing engineer on the project, which is, you know, the upgrade project that we've been working on for several years. It's Murray Smith Consulting Engineers. And to have them do a, you know, special work, which is outside of the original contract that we have with them, to design, essentially start from initial feasibility, evaluating options, going through final design and bid document preparation. And what we're suggesting is that a task order type of contract be developed so that we negotiate a scope, schedule, and budget for each task order that comes out with a not-to-exceed amount of $100,000. So I'd like to get started with Murray Smith as soon as possible, and this emergency declaration will allow staff to waive, I suppose, for lack of a better term, the procurement process for competitive bid and just sole source this.
And so, Tom, is this would be a final design?
Yeah, for $100,000, yeah, it would be a, that's what I've asked them, and they seem to be okay with that. It's a pretty rough guess right up front. You know, we're not getting into a whole lot of the details. But yeah, I think $100,000 should be sufficient.
So Tom, what is it that we're suggesting doing?
Well, the first task is doing a feasibility, maybe for like $10,000. Looking at several different options of, you know, how to do this next step repair work, the engineering. And
is this is this beyond the temporary pipeline that's laying there now, or something else?
Well, it's taking that temporary pipeline and making it more stable, or finding another way to supply water in an emergency situation to Colum Bay. Like, for instance, one of the comments last week by Mr. Baker was to find a new source over on the Colum Bay side. Well, we reviewed our water right portfolio, and we do have a water right on the Clallam Bay side that we want to look into possibly building that out for emergency water supply. So what
I saw the video of the landslide. I guess it's still moving, or was moving. The temporary pipeline is in jeopardy. So is that what makes this an emergency, that we need to come up with a more permanent solution? Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is. So getting that, you know, besides replacing the pipeline with another source, we're looking at different ways to make this pipeline, the bypass pipeline, more stable. And one of those is to drill through the bedrock under those slide zones, those two slide zones. And I've contacted the driller that we worked with on the Bagley Creek project for Highway 101, where we had to do horizontal directional drilling to install a pipeline under Bagley Creek for like 750 feet. So I contacted them, and they came up with a unit price for drilling through some of the bedrock there underlying the slide soils. It's about 20 feet deep. Luckily, we had drilled soil borings in those areas where the slides occurred as part of our previous engineering studies for replacement of the pipeline. So that gave them really good information to give us a good price per foot. And it's looking reasonable.
Oh.
In one of the other alternatives is bringing pipeline down from the prison. You know, that's 1,100 feet long, whereas the direct line along the bay is only 3,600 feet long. It's a lot shorter route, and it's from a life cycle cost perspective, it's a lot less pipeline to maintain over the time. So we're continuing to look at ways to get the pipe back in place along the bay.
Did you need to stay 11,000 feet from the prison down to where you need it? You said 1,100.
11,000.
Okay. And what kind of, what is this water right? Is it from a stream or?
It is from a stream.
Okay.
The priority date is 1958. We've never really used it, but it's still on the books, and it's for one CFS, which is approximately 450 gallons per minute. That would be a pretty good source. I don't think we can get that much out, but even if we got 50 gallons a minute, we could use it as an emergency source.
Yeah.
Just need to treat it.
Well, I think we're always going to have landslides along that section of 112, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate to bring this up, but, you know, years ago we were going to do a boring underneath the hole, and we provided all the information to the contractor. He was not successful, and he blamed our information, so let's be careful there.
Yes, that's legend here.
Yeah, I know.
In the water department.
And, okay.
Yeah.
Are you going to give us an update? I know DOT has looked at doing something with the landslide. And they want to bring in all kind of experts, and it's going to be kind of a long-term activity. Like to hear that story.
Well, you know, WSDOT, when I first called them up, asked them, you know, really pressed them for a schedule to clear that slide. They said it's not an emergency because they were able to get a detour around, up and around the prison to get from CQ to Clown Bay. And so we promptly wrote letters to the higher ups at WSDOT, you know, signed by Doug. And they got back to us and said, well, it's just not safe to send our people out there onto the landslide. When it stabilizes, we'll get out there and we'll start coming up with solutions. So, you know, I've heard, you know, from the field that maybe it's going to be May before they get in there.
but Tom, they did change it from at least a not a priority to a high priority, at least in writing to us. So, I mean, that was a positive. But now, of course, this is what, December 13th, and it's winter, and Forks continues to get rain and snow for the next 2 or 3 months. So that's why Tom's designated this as an emergency.
You would think it would be, things would have to begin to dry out to be completely safe to do anything with that slide. But anyway.
Yeah, it has expanded. Since we laid down the pipe, it's the east side has gotten it's not a full-on failure of the hill slope, but there is a lot of surface erosion of soils, and it's coming down over the road and expanded in width by about 200 feet.
Wow.
So it was 400 feet, now it's 600 feet wide. And you can see big boulders and rock coming down off of the side of the hill, outside of the main slide zone. So it's getting worse. It didn't get so much worse over last weekend when we had that last storm. But the frequency of storms is pretty high right now, and I'm not sure if it's going to let up. So we're still in an emergency. We're not out of the woods yet.
So our temporary pipeline, it sounds like it could be in jeopardy. Do we have a contingency plan if that ends up going away?
No, we still have the bottled water and truck water route, and we'll have to just go in there and make a repair on the pipeline if it does happen. you know, we'll just have to shut it down on both sides and go in, and if it's safe, you know, to go in there and try to repair it.
Yeah. Wow. Well,
I move that we accept resolution 2228-21, amending resolution 2221-21, declaring an emergency and authorizing emergency repair work on the Clallam Bay Siskiyou line.
I second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2228-21, amending resolution 2222-21. Declaring an emergency and authorizing a certain emergency work without formal bid for repair of the HOCO pump station and construction of a bypass pipeline on Highway 112 along Clallam Bay. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Doug, I would like an update from either you or Tom on how we're doing on this emergency task order, what the progress is, maybe once a week or whenever there's a, you know, sooner if there's an important milestone or decision made.
Well, we can do that.
Will do.
Thanks.
So do we have a schedule for from this contractor yet, or what do they think it'll take to do this work?
For MSA, Murray Smith, yeah, since they're already familiar with the project because they've been working on this area for a year and a half, you know, they can start right away, basically, okay, as soon as we get the task order contract in place. So that'll probably take a week. And then, you know, they can start right after that on the first task. And I'm hoping within maybe another couple of weeks we could have that first task order down, or by the end of the year, to, you know, lay out our options.
Tom, why don't we plan, because the next meeting possibly won't be until January. When you do get a schedule from them, why don't we send that out to the commissioners, okay?
Okay.
Good. Yeah, that'd be great.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Welcome.
All right, our next item is resolution 2227-21, appointing a finance manager / treasurer. Sean, I think you have that one.
I do, and this one is an exciting resolution for me to present. So Jamie Spence, our human resources manager, John Purvis, our assistant general manager, myself, we recently conducted interviews to backfill the vacancy that's going to be created when I leave my post. And so we held interviews for the position the week before last. We had three very strong internal candidates. And after a thorough and tough interview process, the interview team unanimously selected Ruth Cook to fill the role. She's been with the district for 17 years, and we've worked side by side during my tenure in the role. And we'll have a pretty low learning curve, I would say, due to her knowledge of the duties and tasks for the position, just having worked side by side together. So for practical purposes, I think she'll be able to hit the ground running out of the gate. She's also been an integral part of the budget process, all of our bond issuances, cost of service studies. And because of all that, we are pleased to recommend her as the next finance manager of the district. She's also built and fostered some pretty key relationships within the industry and received some pretty impressive letters of recommendation from Nancy Neris, our bond counsel attorney, Dick Schober, our bond underwriter, one of the branch managers of our financial institution that we deal with on a daily basis, as well as some pretty key individuals, senior managers here at the district who she's worked with side by side over those 17 years. So staff enthusiastically recommends the board approve resolution 2227-21, appointing Ruth Cook as the finance manager treasurer of the district effective January 16, 2022, and rescind resolution 2103-18. There is a slight amendment to the resolution that's in your board packet. I'm not sure if you all saw it, but he sent out an updated resolution today, and it's on item 3, the resolution, it should say that resolution 2103-18 is rescinded effective 11:59 p.m. January 15th, 2022. So if you didn't see that from T, it's in your inbox. But there is just that slight amendment to the resolution. So
yes, I have that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're lucky. We've got some good people to backfill this job with. I've known Ruth for many years, and she has always been very professional and right on the front line. So do we have a motion?
Yeah, I move that we support resolution 22-27-21 appointing Ruth Cook as the finance manager and treasurer.
I second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 2227-21, appointing Ruth Cook as finance and manager and treasurer, and to rescind resolution 2103-18, effective 11:59 p.m. January 15th, 2022. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, thank you. Congratulations, Ruth.
Congratulations.
All right.
Thank you very much, commissioners.
Okay, good. We expect a lot, Ruth, but okay, we're going to move G down to below I on the agenda. So now we're on to resolution 2226-21, changing the boundaries of the commissioner districts of Clallam County PUD number one. Sean, do you have that one?
I do. excuse me. So as presented at the last board meeting, the district has to adopt new boundaries with each decennial census. And we showed in our presentation that we have to rebalance the current districts based on the population statistics that came forward. So basically we're moving a few from District 1 to 2 and then a few from District 2 to 3. Because the population is shifting to the east towards SWIM is where the majority of the growth is. So these changes are documented on the proposed 2021 PUD district map that's attached to the resolution before you. Since our last meeting, we did receive two inquiries from customers on the redistricting process. However, we did not receive any comments requesting any changes or alterations to the proposed map. And so with that, staff recommends that the board adopt resolution 2226-21, changing the boundaries of the commissioner districts and rescinding the prior map resolution 1954-11. And with that, we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, questions, comments, motion?
Yeah, I have some comments, and mostly, you know, when you presented this last time, there was a slide there about the inclusion of Port Angeles as part of the voting base for commissioners. We didn't have a whole lot to say about it in the meeting, the slide and the information presented left a lot of open questions. I've since learned in the meantime that, you know, when this PUD was first voted on in 1938, it was defeated by the voters because it did not include Port Angeles and other little areas of the county, and because it was to be a countywide PUD. And so when it was was put before the voters again a couple of years later, it was established as a countywide PUD, and that's what the voters resoundingly supported. Now, in 1981 or so, that was changed, and the indication that we have is we don't know why. I've been told staff has worked on checking into this, but we can't seem to find much information about this. So it's a bit concerning to me that we would change something when we don't know why we're changing it, and it's also become clear to me in talking with other PUD commissioners and former county commissioners, you know, this is a requirement that that this countywide PUD include in this case, given the circumstances that we discussed in executive session, that it should include the city of Port Angeles. And also it's apparent that there are other PUDs that are countywide PUDs and do have precincts, entire precincts, without ratepayers in them that are voting for county commissioners. And so my view right now is that I believe we should include the city of Port Angeles in the as part of the voting districts or precincts for the Clallam County PUD commissioners.
Well, I think back to your statement that we don't know the reason why. You know, in 1981, the boundaries were drawn excluding Port Angeles. And the logic of that's pretty sound, that since they have their own utilities, electric, water, wastewater, and so on, they've pretty well jealously protected their ability to serve within the city of Port Angeles, including annexation of our facilities. And so there's also been objection to PUD's taxing authority in the city of Port Angeles, which we could exercise. So, you know, as a service to our existing customers and the way they've been for the last 40 years, including a large percentage of voters who have no vested interest in the PUD, is kind of defies logic. But, Rick, did you have anything on this?
Do you have any documentation to that effect of what you just said about what happened in 1981?
I have documentation that they had existing utilities at that point, and we were not serving that area there. So we can easily establish that. Rick, did you have anything?
I move that we accept Resolution 2226-21, changing the boundaries of the commissioners' districts of Clallam County PUD 1.
Okay, and I'll second that. It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 2226-21, changing the boundaries of the commissioner districts of Public Utility District Number 1 of Clallam County, and to rescind Resolution 1954-11. All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
I'm opposed.
Okay, thank you. All right, so our next item would be, I guess we'll move on into the BPA post-2028 contract discussion.
Yeah, and Will John's going to talk about the memo that we received today from Ryan Neal at WAPEG about the Clark undedicating a resource.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I wanted to make sure that commissioners at least had an opportunity to get Ryan's proposed comments associated with undedicating a portion of the River Road gas plant in Clark County. As a point of discussion for BPA 2028. During a WAPEG meeting last week, there was a discussion on this. Several utilities expressed agreement with what was worded that came out in this document subsequently. And a couple other utilities were reserved and wanted to have internal discussions before signing off on this WAPEG support. In addition to that, for review, the Clark River Road generating capacity is about 248 megawatts. The current dedication is 225 megawatts. The proposed dedication is 102 average megawatts, essentially retaining River Road to transition more of a peaker gas plant. And the only thing that we can convey now is, staff does believe that if 123 megawatts were undedicated. At some point in time in the future, it would likely allow Clark to make an additional claim of between 1.5 and 2% of the Tier 1 system. That's a negative, but there's also positives that were conveyed in the WAPEG meeting regarding the advantages of undedicating a portion of this resource as opposed to letting it play out in court or some other means. Sean, do you have any information on PPC, late information?
Yeah, Ryan, I asked him today if PPC had come out in support of Clark in this endeavor, and he said that PPC has also issued draft comments similar to WAPEG in support, and it's with their executive committee right now, and they will vote on that tomorrow. But it looks like all signs are pointing to support from PPC.
Yeah, John, I think dedication is pretty obvious as to its meaning, but for folks listening in, you might explain that.
Okay, so when a utility dedicates a resource, they basically tell BPA and the world that we have this resource for all planning purposes for the duration of the project or the life of the equipment normally, that this is where they're going to get their power from. And all other entities, including that entity, makes plans around that. So, for example, we have a dedicated resource with a substantial portion of our Packwood generation. It's declared. It effectively supplants, over the long term, BPA Tier 1.
Okay. Hey, John, I have a question. Does the difference between their dedicated amount now and what they're reducing to, does that difference, does CETA allow them to sell that on the open market?
You know, we haven't done the analysis, but I believe during the interim period of 2030 to 44, my opinion, and I have not dug into it, is that they could market that amount elsewhere, conceivably. But I do not know of the ins and outs because when we did our examination of CETA, since we did not have any resources like this, we did not take a deep dive.
I've discussed this with some of these.
Too, because they're not going to do what I would call a financial analysis. They say they don't need to. And that would be why. That would be a reason why that would be true.
Yeah, I have talked to some of their commissioners, and, you know, they're leaning towards becoming a load-following full requirements customer under the new contracts. And this is part of their logic here, but in any case.
On a personal basis, I'm a big fan of public power, and therefore, personally, I support this. But when I took this position, to represent the customers of Clallam County, and I can't find anything that benefits the customers of Clallam County for supporting this. I'm open to hearing if any of the other commissioners know of any benefit. But if they don't have any, then I'm opposed.
Rick, I don't know of any other benefits. I agree with what you're saying. I think the impact is small, but there is, Sean, if I'm correct in what you said earlier, it is a slight negative benefit. So I too am not. I'm either neutral or not in favor of it.
I'm opposed to it, and I think we should send a letter on the 15th saying that.
Well, since there's such a small impact, I guess I would favor just staying neutral on this. Let Clark and BPA sort it out. And that way we would not go counter to WAPEG. And
yeah. So basically, from our understanding, there are some advantages and a big disadvantage. The advantages are somewhat subjective, speculative. You know, there's a potential resource adequacy concern, but we don't know what that looks like. You know, we don't know what's going to happen to the plant. There's a chance that Clark will pursue a legal remedy, and they may be successful in dedicating the entire dedication of 225 megawatts, but we just don't know. So right now, we just don't know.
From a resource adequacy point of view, this is a facility that certainly needs to stay around for peaking. But having said that, is Clark willing to operate it as a peaking facility? Would they be, could they recover their cost of maintaining a plant just for peaking?
Well, based on the information available, we don't really know. It was inferred that they wanted to transition River Road to a peaking, more of a peaking facility. We think BPA is a little bit nervous about losing that capacity, and we think they have an inclination to undedicate, but we really don't know. This is really something new. You know, normally things like this happen when plants are retired. This is the first time you have state legislation that for Clark is requiring them to unload or do something about generation they have. So, like I say, there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, and it's all a consequence of CETA, I guess.
Well, you know, I asked the question that you're basically getting at of Tom at Clark. And, you know, that's when he said, well, we're really not doing an economic analysis, but it's kind of telling, you know, the question is, well, how the hell do you keep a peaker going? Well, you can't unless it's selling that power someplace
exactly.
At some level in the meantime. In other words, they would on the open market. So if that's what they're doing, you know, and they can make money at that. And part of his answer was, oh, we've already paid for the plant. And so, you know, they look at it like as if they're just paying O&M on it. And they're able to sell their difference on the open market, and they're still making money, and it's there as a peaker, and on the bet that if it's needed as a peaker, it's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah, let's remember that they diversified on their own. They chose to move away from Bonneville, yeah. And you know, and they did that because they were making money. And I don't know, there's something that doesn't feel right about it to me, where they say, well, you know, we're big enough, we can go off and make money on this, and all of a sudden, oh, now we got to shut it down, so let's go back and take energy away from the rest of the full requirements customers. I don't know, it just doesn't feel right to me.
So can they operate that facility, and will the power, I guess, outside Washington under CETA? I mean, CETA's concerned about CO2 emissions, and so they would continue to emit CO2. So it doesn't sound logical that they could operate, but except maybe as a peaker.
They're selling it to Portland, most likely.
But they still are emitting CO2 in Washington. So
yeah, good point, Will.
So I'm not sure how that's going to fly with CETA.
Well, I'll throw it out there. I move that we oppose this, and that we send a letter to Bonneville stating that.
You know, staying neutral sounds like a better approach.
Yeah, I guess that's my view, too, is we just ought to be silent on it.
Okay, so basically, would it be okay if we advise Ryan that RPUD is not signing off? We're not, you know, making any, not making a decision one way or the other, primarily due to insufficient information.
Sounds like you just voiced the
otherwise,
truth.
Otherwise, what Ryan is proposing is he's going to send that letter, and then our name will be included.
No, or we will have to specifically tell them that our name is not included.
Right.
We do not agree with it, and or at least we do not agree with that form. And we may or may not make comments on our own, but there's insufficient information to really make a definitive decision one way or the other.
So our name shouldn't be included.
Yeah, our name, no, if we do not agree to including our name, we have to let Ron know that, you know, we're going to make our own comments when we have more information.
So how many players are there in this, John? Do we know? WAPEG, is that right?
Yeah, WAPEG. My guess is, you know, there's going to be a few people or a few utilities who want to hold off. We heard one or two during the meeting. I think they're probably going to get sign off from, you know, 75 or 80% of the members, or at least I don't care from that number, and we'll be excluded.
Yeah, so.
And we'll simply say that, you know, we'd like to be excluded. We're going to make our own comments. And we want to be excluded due to lack of information, and we'll probably make our own comments at a later date.
So we're not going to have a lot of impact one way or another, is what you're saying?
No, probably not. We can take a principal stand if that's the belief that, you know, we're not ready to jump on board.
Okay.
Works for me.
All right. So we have agreement then on that. All right, let's move back. Other discussion on BPA?
None from me.
Okay, let's move back to the strategic plan. Sean,
I misunderstood your question, Will. Yeah, I've got some comments on the 2028 process.
Ah, okay, go ahead.
Let me start with WAPEG since we were just talking about them. They had a meeting, a couple meetings actually, but one of them had to do with the concept paper that the public utility group that's not, was meeting separately from BPA, worked up a concept paper. And I noticed in the recent version, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'll probably get the quote a little wrong, but one of the principles was, the last part of it was preserving the existing FCRPS. And I think that falls in my book, the realm of be careful what you ask for here, because, you know, we're sitting here in 2021 and this is going to go out basically 25 years. And, as we've all noted in the cost management discussions, which I have another point I need to make about that, there's a lot of really big questions about what's going on with cost here. And so, my suggestion, for us is to comment back on the concept paper and say, we really think we should be trying to optimize our FCRPS, you know, given all the renewables and coal closures and all this kind of stuff, but not use the word preserve or preserving, whatever it says. I just think that's just a mandate for BPA to ignore the cost of the system. And, so anyway, that's one point I want to make in terms of the.
I disagree with that.
Why?
Because I think that as we move forward and we get more and more load from electric vehicles and we get more of the intermittent resources, the value of the hydro system is going to become more and more valuable. So therefore, I think we should preserve the whole system. So I agree with the statement.
Okay. Well, to me, optimizing gets at what you're talking about, but there's a cost associated with this.
You bet.
And if we don't know what the cost is, you know, we're just, you know, we could be shooting ourselves in the foot here.
Well, I'm on a resource adequacy task force, and we had a discussion about the touted low cost of renewables these days, and we're hearing numbers from solar and wind that are non-firm. They're not backed up. They're intermittent. So that's not the real cost. And so if you want to get to the real cost, you have to double or more those costs that are touted for renewables. So I think that the hydro system is going to be necessary going forward with the additional load that Rick mentioned, and I think we need to support that.
Well, okay. So, and then here's some other comments. With the Waputa meeting, we had Teresa Hampton from one of the associations that provides generation information and so forth. And she talked about several things that were you know, kind of following the lines that you're talking about, resource adequacy, and that, you know, the amount of surplus energy is bad for sellers, and that the wind and solar will have demonic effects on our system, which, this is a lot of fear talk here. But when I asked her at the end of her presentation, what assumptions did she make about the hydro system? She said, well, that's a good question. And her answer was, but I don't know. And so once again, we have another group like the Power and Conservation Council, like BPA themselves and other associations that don't even want to take up the subject of what the hydro system costs and what it's going to cost in the future as things get harder to replace. And we know that you can look at what BPA's capital investment program is, and it's been underfunded by about $100 million for the last 6 or 7 years. And they keep plugging in $300 million as their goal. And that doesn't even pay for a lot of rehabs and replacements that are on the books or should be on the books. They don't no longer on the books because they just can't pencil them out at $300 million a year. But we haven't even made it to $300 million a year because of the inability of BUREC and the Corps to execute. But nevertheless, I think it's just really short-sighted to not press and get the powers to be. And obviously, the Power Council is a good place to start since it's really part of their mandate to come up with what the asset – the real asset value is of these hydro projects. And so that's why I'm concerned about, these discussions in the 2028 process. And just a sort of in a strategic sense that plays into our strategic plan, you know, we've been through this now almost a year with the BPA PPC workshops. And, you know, there was a lot of good information put in there. I learned a few things I didn't know about some of these, you know, kind of tangential areas. But a lot of those don't even affect. You know, Rick talked, you talk about what's good for the Clallam County PUD customers. Well, a lot of that stuff was talked about. It has very little or no impact on this PUD just because of the nature of our contract and our location and our customer base and stuff like this. So I believe that we should be more attentive to the cost side of this thing. So let me see if there was any other comments I had in regards to the meetings I've been listening to in the last 2 weeks. I'll cover some of that in my commissioner comments, but that's relative to the contract side itself. That's that, and then if there's more discussion on that as it relates to this contract process and what we're heading into, I'll wait or otherwise hold it to the strategic conversation.
Okay, thank you, Jim. All right, ready to move on to strategic plan. This item G, we moved.
Yes.
Good. Sean, let's. How long is that going to be, Sean? Are you going to?
No, it's not a presentation, Will. I just was going
to. Ah, okay, great. I was going to say let's break, but we'll go through this first, and then we'll take a break.
Okay. So in your board packet is staff's proposed final version of the strategic plan. And as we discussed last meeting, we added one strategic initiative based on Jim's comments related to negotiations with Bonneville. And this was added to the Manage Our Resource Portfolio strategic objective. Item 10 under the initiatives reads, engage with BPA provider of choice 2028 contract negotiations and coordinate with associations to ensure district concerns are addressed. And under that same objective, we added item H to the big gaps, which is no long-term power contract post-2028. So those were the two changes that we made to the plan, and we received no further comments from the public, and so staff was seeking approval from the board to notate in the minutes that you approve of the strategic plan so that we can post to our website. I believe that, Jim, you might have some additional changes that you had alluded to that you'd like to see.
Yeah, well, let's just jump off on what I've been saying about the changing nature of the energy situation in the next 25 years in the Northwest, and what I've said about the aging nature of the hydro system and how extensive it is going to be to maintain that. But at the same time, we do have, it's interesting. The groups we belong to tend to look at CETA and things like this and solar and wind and batteries as sort of a tainted, almost negative impact, a demonic impacts on our system. Instead of looking at this stuff as an opportunity to build more resiliency locally, incorporate some, these evolving technologies as rapidly as possible, because the prices are, getting lower, and whether you will believe they're there or not right now, they're certainly probably cheaper than Hanford, Columbia Generating Station, which, oh, by the way, I've noticed that it's been off for, what, a week? I'm curious to know what's going on there, Will, when I finish. Our strategic plan really, I think, is short here. It's a really good plan in terms of management objectives and tying our budget to stuff and so forth like that. But I think it's weak. And now, this is not the first time I've brought this up. We talked about it at length each year. And the comments I had about along with this nature were kind of struck out last time. But I think it's really important. I think in the plan here it says we need to do a deep dive every 3 or 4 years, and I don't think we've done that really. Maybe that's what it was the very first time I experienced this 3 years ago, but I don't know. But I think it's worthy of an offsite, or I don't know what you want to call it, but a team working on this and maybe get some input, maybe involve the public, some folks from the public, our customer, our rate base in, our rate payers, and have some discussion, have a public meeting about this or something. I just think it we're sort of, just not being real strategic here given the nature of the energy markets and so forth. So that's an overarching thing that I believe needs to be embedded in here. I also note that you took out from last year's strategic plan under manage our resource portfolio, you took out evaluate cost-effective demonstration projects associated with EV charging, battery storage, community solar, and microgrid technologies. And I thought that that was one of the important things to have in there is that it dealt with the resiliency issues, smaller scale stuff, and even this woman that briefed with PUDA was suggesting when somebody asked her what we should be doing, she that was one of her key things is to think more about what we can do within our local PUDs to ensure resilience and lower price and low prices for our ratepayers. So I'm not sure why we took that out, but I would suggest we put that or something very similar to that back in. Folks, and so that's one specific. The other one, Doug, I guess, is I notice under all the key performance indicators it says how are we doing / measurement. And unless I just I questioned this last year. We show the indicators, and it looks to me like these are all measurements. What we're measuring, but I don't see how we are doing. Now, maybe I missed it someplace during the year. We had a how we are doing on our KPIs, but I don't recall that. But how are we, and that's a specific question right now. When do we see that? I mean, we just did the 2020, and it seemed like we would want to know exactly how we came out on these KPIs before we jump off into another strategic plan with these same, what appear to be the same KPIs. So that's my overarching comment. One specific ad I'd like to see, and maybe a suggestion on doing a deep dive right away. Maybe we can approve this one with some modifications, but we really need to do a deep dive on our strategy. And then what about the KPIs?
So first question, are the other two commissioners, do you guys want to see the us add back in the microgrid comment that was deleted that Jim talked about?
Well, I guess in my opinion, that's pretty broad. I mean, we're not into R&D, so I think that's one reason it was taken out, that, you know, we can follow along with the industry and with other utilities and see what they're doing. But investing money and effort into doing that on our own just seems a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah, that particular project, we were looking for assistance from a grant that didn't come through.
Yeah.
Why we took it out, but
well, there's going to be more grant money.
Well, we're not assured we're going to get it, though. Rick, what do you think?
I agree at this time. This time, I agree with Will.
Okay. So the other thing about you mentioned about the metrics, were you going to talk about that, Sean?
I think Doug came on to talk about the KPIs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think we had one or two reports throughout the year, and we're actually should be doing it quarterly this year. Continue, I guess, to use COVID a little bit as an excuse here, but I've talked to Sean already, and maybe in January they can give you a fourth quarter report for the year, which would normally be when we would do it. And we can look at the KPIs now. The KPIs are used there just to see how we're doing, and they do indicate through the different red, green, yellow type indicators in the KPI how we are doing. So if the KPI is, let's say, green, it means that we're meeting the categories that are in that particular KPI. And in the past, in our quarterly reports, we're basically just looking and reporting on the ones that are yellow and red, instead of, in other words, bringing to the commissioners ones where we might have a problem or we're behind schedule, but not necessarily spending the time on things that are going as indicated per the KPIs or the green indicators. So I think we do give an indication on how things are going, Jim, with that, with the red, yellow, or green.
I must be colorblind then, because the green, the yellow, and the red are all highlighted in the respective color. Little arrows are all the same colors.
Right.
So I guess I'm a little slow here on the uptake.
No, but that's what I'm saying. When we do give the quarterly report, if something's not in green, we'll report on that.
Well, why wouldn't we show the results here in our strategic plan?
Because the strategic plan is used for the whole year, and it can change throughout the year. So in the first quarter, we might be fine. Things might be, well, let me look at the first one I turned to was provide stable rates. If it's green, it's within 5% of the budget. If it's yellow, it's within 5 to 8% of the budget, and red, 8% of the budget. So in the quarterly report, if it's going over 5% of the budget, between 5 to 8%, we'll give a report to the commission saying that the provide stable rates now is no longer within the 5% budget, but has changed into the 5 to 8% budget. So the strategic plan is just the document that we use to provide the report to the commissioners. So quarterly, you would see if something's changed on these 11. There's 11 objectives, and quarterly you would find out whether they're all green and within the KPIs, or if they're outside of the KPIs, the commissioners would get reports on it.
And well, KPIs are well defined and then aligned with the color coding, so that kind of answers the question about how we're doing.
Right.
You can't see that here. You mentioned quarterly reports, but we don't get a quarterly briefing on KPIs, and I don't know that we need one, but we certainly ought to have an annual complete roll-up to match, you know, as part of our strategic discussion in terms of, because you've got these things in here, and, you know, they're part of your plan, and you say, how are we doing? And, you know, it's just simply not there.
Well, it is there, Jim.
I'm confused.
I guess I haven't explained it properly, but the key performance, how are we doing? It's a measurement. So if you're within 5% of the budget, you're green. If you're outside of that, we will report quarterly whether we're outside of that. And in January, they can give you a complete update on, normally just on outside of the green or the outside of the key budget, key performance indicators that show that it's no longer within the green.
Okay, so you're going to do that in January?
That's the plan.
And we do get reports on this every time we look at the strategic plan. We can look at those KPIs and the color coding that goes with them, and it kind of makes it simpler and easier to understand.
Right, that's the purpose of it. Now, KPIs, when you look at them, they're one of the most difficult things to establish, and we spent time over the years establishing those KPIs. So it's an indicator, but it's kind of, I guess the consultant that helped us set up the KPIs when we first started, he was in a business that, well, he was a consultant for balance scorecards and KPIs, and one of his KPIs for his business was how many phone calls he gets. Because the more phone calls he gets, the more business he's going to get. So KPIs aren't always exact, but they're the best indicator you can get on how you're doing. So within 5% of our budget for the one is, if we're staying within that 5%, we're saying we're doing good. Now, whether that should be 3% or 2%, you know, that's something that we would discuss in a deep dive. Now, we did do a deep dive, I think it was, although time goes fast, but I think it was 3 years ago. So we're in that time frame between 3 to 5. And Sean and I had talked, and I believe Sean's planning on doing a deep dive next year. Is that what we talked about, Sean? Is that right?
Correct. Yep.
So that is.
Okay, well, Doug, I know what a KPI is, so that's not the question. The question is, it'd be nice if we're going to have a strategic plan discussion. Say, all right, how are our measurements panning out so that we know, the commissioners know, and everybody else, the public knows, that this is what we set out to do strategically. And here's, from a strategic standpoint, you know, once a year, for instance, since this is talked about once a year, just lay out how we came up on each one of these KPIs. Was it green, red, or yellow? And if it was red or yellow, let's talk about it.
Okay.
I think from what I'm hearing from Doug, that's pretty well what we're doing. So did I miss something?
That's what I heard, Will.
Did we do it this last January?
I think we might have. I'm not
sure. Yeah, we've done it in the past year, I'm sure.
Did it once or twice. The intent is to do a quarterly, Jim. And I'm telling you, it's my fault that we didn't do it every quarter. But Sean's going to be better at that.
So I guess, are you okay approving in the minutes the 2022 strategic plan under the caveat that we will give a presentation next month with the 2021 results?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. So
I agree with that.
Well, I agree with looking at the results next month, if that's what you're talking about, yeah.
Okay.
We can talk about future meetings, whether we need to have a work session to do a more of a deep dive, as you describe it, Jim, and maybe more specificity than we're doing here now. So, okay. So let's see. Let's take a 5-minute break. I'm ready.
Okay, well, I guess we need approval on the strategic plan as it is.
You need a resolution? I thought we got the nod from two commissioners there.
Okay. All right. I wasn't sure that it was on the total strategic plan. So if you have a nod from two of you, that's great.
Yeah, I asked them, Doug, for the minutes if they could approve it, and Will and Rick said yes, and Jim, I think, is okay as long as we give the results next month.
Okay. But,
Jim, that was a qualified yes, I believe, but anyway. Okay, 5-minute break. Let's get back at 3:05. Thank you. Okay, it looks like everybody's back, so let's reconvene and move on to correspondence communication. Doug, Sean, do we have anything?
No, I don't have anything.
Okay, good. Okay, commissioner reports. Jim, you want to lead us off?
Yeah, let's see. A couple of bullets that I didn't bring up in some of the meetings I've already discussed, but I'll some additional points that in the Wapruda meeting when I talked about the address the uncontrollable cost and so forth, and pointed out that with the lady Teresa Hampton that you know, about the not having a cost estimate and that the aging hydro system was, you know, lacking an industrial base like it did when all this stuff was built. Anyway, I noted that Ron Skagen from Douglas PUD, who has the hydro project, so he knows what he's talking about, was, he said, he commented that he, you know, that I was right in that regard and that we should be concerned about the cost of these hydro projects. It's not easy financially. I also commented on it about a month ago at the BPA cost management workshop, BPA PPC 2028. I sent a comment in addressing these uncontrollable costs as being a large part of BPA's cost and so forth, and how it affected ramp, whether you ramp on or you can ramp off or have off ramps in these contracts or durations and kind of tie all that together. That question was more or less paraphrased the other day when they reported out during the energy efficiency workshop. They had that comment in there. It was the very last one. I had a conflict, so I couldn't listen to it. Maybe Sean heard something more specifically, or you guys did. But in the written response, it was interesting because they finally wheedled around and simply said, well, we didn't mean to, when we were talking about uncontrollable costs, we were only talking about short term, and they admitted that there are long term costs and that some of that stuff that's uncontrollable now is likely controllable as a long-term cost. But there was no discussion of how, okay, well, all right, so what is it and how are we going to get to it? And again, that reinforces my point about we're flying blind in here and we're using a rear-view mirror looking back 20 years to get there. There was also a North Olympic Development Council meeting. I'm trying to, maybe I didn't write it down, but anyway, one thing that was interesting about the work they did in terms of the workforce and so forth here is that for Clallam County, and this is a rough, I'm just memorizing gross numbers, but it's something like probably 85% of our ratepayers are either government employees or quasi-government, like the hospital employees, or retirees. And so this, you know, that's our base. That's who is paying buying our electricity. And single load users are having a tough time getting into the system. And so it really constrained Clallam County's ability to grow. And so we're not. Under those conditions, there's not a whole lot of incentive, and so I just point that out. And I guess it's something that again it needs to be brought into a strategic conversation when we look at our plan. So that's all I got, Will.
I don't understand. A single load user has trouble getting into the system. What does that mean?
Well, that means there have been both power generators and people that are looking to use power, you know, in the Clallam County area over the last couple of years that I've been listening to, that for various reasons, mostly having to do with BPA's onerous processes for interconnection or the cost or something like that, have had difficulty. And I think John, of course, Purvis has worked with some of these folks in the past and probably can give you, you know, can discuss it in a lot more clarity and fidelity than I possibly can.
Yeah, well, really the probably the biggest deterrent to new large loads is the BPA new large single load restriction under the North the Powers Act. So basically any prospective customer looking at coming in with 10 average megawatts either has to procure power outside of BPA and still be subject to CETA, decarbonization in the future, or they're going to pay an effective twice the low load hour and high load hour rates for BPA supply. So that's probably the primary deterrent. And there's another deterrent a little bit above that amount, having to do with transmission capacity on the North Peninsula. We have some margin for growth, but if the growth were to exceed, let's say, 30 or 40 megawatts, then BPA has conveyed that they have voltage stability concerns in some configurations.
Hey, John, the 10 megawatts, that number is not actually in the Power Act, is it?
I believe it is. I believe there's a specific reference to large single load customer additions. And when I don't think the amount that BPA charges per se is necessarily in there. I'd have to review it. But functionally, and what BPA conveys is, whenever we had such a request, they quoted a high load hour and low load hour rate that is roughly twice the rate of their tier one supply.
Okay, ready to move on?
Yes.
Okay, Rick, go ahead.
I was at the WAPUTA annual meeting, which I thought they did a good job. I really enjoyed the EV presentation, provider of choice meeting, and the concept paper meeting, which I agreed with the concept paper. That's all I've got, Will.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I attended the WAPAC meeting on Clark, and I think we've talked that one to death, so nothing there. I also attended the WAPUTA annual meeting. Of course, it was virtual. Tommy Holmes, director of the American Water Works Association, gave a very interesting talk about water issues and the infrastructure bill. And it appears that under the infrastructure bill, EPA will have primary responsibility for enforcing that, distributing the funding and all the other stuff. I guess one of the items came up about contaminants, and PFAS was something that we've talked about before. Sounds like there's more coming on that. And another item was there's $250 million in there for small water systems, which has surfaced in this area, and we've had some crosstalk with the county about and so on. So there may be money there to address some of those issues. There's also a lot of requirements in there about cybersecurity for water systems, which will be, again, will be policed by EPA. So there will be more of that, I'm sure. Rick mentioned the Evita, the Energy Northwest lady, that she's not only leads the EV effort for Energy Northwest, she's also active in a number of EV organizations that promote the use of EVs and so on. She gave some interesting statistics here, talking about charging stations. The level one, which is the lowest level, you can get 4 miles per hour of charge from a level one charging station. So that would only be useful for overnight charging for, you know, commuters. For a level two, 240 volt, would be 25 miles per hour of charge. And level three, which is a DC, it's a fast charger, there would be 200 miles for 1 to 2 hours of charge. So, you know, it kind of begs the question that in rural areas, are charging stations going to be practical for people who are having commute long distances, and are they going to be willing to sit by a charging station or do other things while for an hour or two? She also gave, there's currently 84,000 plug-in and hybrid vehicles in the state of Washington. And there is a website which will give you a county-by-county counting of those, what's on record so far. There's 204 fast chargers in the state of Washington. Then we went on to Therese Hampton, who is a retiring director of the public power pool and the public generators. She gave a very good talk. People seem to save their best talks to when they're retiring. Or maybe it's a risk issue or something, but she gave some pretty good insights into what's going on in her opinion. She gave very candid remarks. Tim Sheldon jumped in with a little discussion on the alignment of the West Coast of the U.S. and Canada, all the way from British Columbia, Oregon, Washington, and California, where positions on energy, positions on climate change, and so on are just about aligned. And he made the statement that some of the positions taken that have been failures, but they've been adopted anyway, most notably what's going on in California. Let's see what else we got here. Then we moved on to talk with Alex Albin, who we talked about the internet, AI, and broadband. And these presentations are always scary. When you talk about cybersecurity and hacking and ransomware and so on, he stated that the city of Atlanta, New York, Baltimore, have all been victims of ransomware, and they paid the, usually in Bitcoin, they've paid to get their systems unlocked. But he pointed out that in one case, they only paid something like $50,000 to get their systems unlocked from ransomware, but it ended up costing them $10 million to rectify the problems. Another item he talked about was the Colonial Pipeline case. You probably remember that last year where there was insufficient gasoline and lines at service stations all up and down the East Coast. You know, the concern is always that hackers can get into your control systems and all this. But in that case, that wasn't part of their operating system. That was their billing and accounting system, which shut them down. So it kind of, there's a lesson to be learned there. We already talked about WAPAG. I was in a resource adequacy task force meeting, and there was a lengthy discussion about Energy Northwest is negotiating with Grant right now. They're interested in building a small modular reactor. And they have hired consultants and done a real deep dive where how they identified nuclear as being a good option. And they had statistics on wind, solar, and all the other optional cases. And some of the information was somewhat new. For example, you know, it's been talked about that if we were geographically diverse, so the wind wasn't blowing in one place, it would be blowing somewhere else. But based on studies, that doesn't hold true in the state of Washington. You either get wind or you don't get wind. And they have found that the operating factor for wind farms is not, we usually say 30%. You can install a 100-megawatt wind farm and you only get 30 megawatts out of it at peak. That's more realistic number would be 19%. So that was interesting. I'm going to get those slides from that presentation, and I'll distribute those to everyone. Let's see, what else? We're in the process of negotiating an agreement with Grant. We've got a memo of understanding. We're trying to look for something a little more firm. But they seem to be on board. I know there was some concern about Kevin North dropping out as the general manager there. He was a real advocate for SMRs. But he is going to be their resource manager. We'll continue in the role of looking at new resources, and he will report directly to their Board of Commissioners. So that was pretty good news. And I guess that's all I had.
Hey, Will.
Yeah. You wanted to hear about the outage.
Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, they replaced the low-pressure turbine during the last outage. And what they do when they balance those things before they ship from the shop. But when you install them, temperature differentials, lube oil, all kind of variables, usually result in a elevated vibration. And it's not elevated to the point there are shutdown systems if it elevates to that point, but it is a bit elevated. So the Siemens, who is the provider for that turbine, recommended that we do a balance shot. That's where you stop the turbine, you stick a weight on the wheel, and then you start it back up, and that's all done with in-depth computer calculations and so on. So the outage was to perform that balance shot. And coincident with that, and with the agreement of Bonneville, we took a little additional outage time to address other issues in the plant. So that's the reason we were down.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if there's no other discussion on that, let's move on to staff reports. Any staff reports, or we've heard all that?
Not today.
Yeah, not today.
None? Okay, good. All right, comments from the public. Sean?
Wait, you missed the board action items, Will.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Board action items.
Do we have board action items?
We do. We have four. The first one is to look into a capacity charge for every rate class. The second is to provide a schedule of emergency repair work for the Clallam Bay CQ water systems to the commissioners as soon as it's available. And then staff is asked to communicate to Ryan Neal at WAPEG that Clallam PUD, due to insufficient information, requests to not be included in the WAPEG comments regarding Clark's proposal to undedicate a portion of its River Road gas plant. And the last item is to present within the first quarter of 2022 to the board on strategic plan key performance indicators that need attention, and that will be those that are colored yellow or red at that time.
Will?
Yes.
I'd like to add another action item for the staff, and that would be to come up with a plan to correct the definition of our territory with the legislature or whomever that needs to be corrected with, so that we in 10 years don't have the same problem that we just ran through.
Okay, good.
Okay, I've got it. Thank you.
Thank you, T.
Okay, thank you. All right, moving on to comments from the public.
Nothing in chat right now, but if anybody from the public would like to make a comment, please let me know now. And just looking at the list here, well, I don't see anybody from the public on.
Okay, good. All right, we do not have an executive session, so if there's no other business to come before the board, we will adjourn.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to everyone. And a Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.